So thank you, Hugo, for the invitation and Blake for that introduction. I'm grateful to have this chance to talk about this project. As Blake said, it's on Indo-European thought in 20th century France, and it's supported by a Leverhulme Major Research Fellowship. And the title I've given you today is deliberately ambiguous. It's intended to signal both the ideology of the people who might be labelled as Indo-Europeans, what they thought, what they believed, and also the ideology of the position that there is such a thing as a people who could be labelled as the Indo-Europeans and some of the politics around that choice. Now, although there are no extant texts, researchers have long hypothesised a proto-Indo-European language, the language from which all of the recorded languages in the Indo-European language, from Sanskrit to Iranian languages to Greek to Latin and so on, that these languages are all derived from that earlier language, and that comparative linguistics has developed sophisticated approaches to try to reconstruct aspects of the vocabulary and grammar of this hypothesized language, Proto-Indo-European. And similar methods have been used in comparative mythology to use the early histories of Rome, the Vedas, the Norse sagas, and other sources to try to develop analyses of a shared mythical and ideological tradition. Now, in 20th century France, much important work was done that was building on earlier European research by, among others, Ferdinand de Saussure, James Frazer, Max Müller. And in the early part of the century, Oral Stein and Paul Pellio and their discoveries at the Duan Hung Caves on the Silk Road made possible analysis of largely unknown languages that was conducted in several countries, but particularly in France, by Antoine Mellet, Robert Gautier and their colleagues. And in parallel, the German-led Turfan expeditions made available a whole range of materials that were analysed by, among others, Friedrich Karl Andreas and his students in Berlin. And at the same kind of time, Henri Hubert and Marcel Mauss are opening up new approaches for comparative anthropology. And among those that are taught in that French tradition are Emile Benveniste and Georges Dumézil. Now, they're both, on the surface, people who have conventional and extremely successful academic careers. They're both educated in France's elite institutions. They're taught by some of the major 20th century names that I just mentioned, including Marcel Gronet, who's a specialist on Chinese civilization, and by Marcel Mauss and by Antoine Mellet. Both of them teach at the École Pratique de Haute Etude and are then later elected to chairs at the Collège de France. Benveniste in 1937 in comparative grammar, Dumézil in 1949 in Indo-European civilization. And then between 1949 and 1968, the two of them are teaching in parallel at the college. Now, while Dumézil's major works are in comparative mythology, he also published extensively on Caucasian languages and folklore. Benveniste is primarily known as a linguist, but he makes crucial contributions to the study of language, culture, tradition, particularly in a book called The Vocabulary, or as in English it now is, The Dictionary of Indo-European Concepts and Society. And Benveniste and Dumézil are the two key figures that I treat in my developing book manuscripts, trying to analyse their publications, their teaching records, their extensive archives, to try and reconstruct the paths of their thought in detail, to try and contextualise their ideas and situate them within a wider institutional history. And behind these exemplary academic careers, I think there's a whole range of underexplored questions. So what I will try to do today is to talk a bit about Dumézil's election to the Collège de France and his inaugural lecture, which I think gives an indication of some of the controversy about his work, to then talk about Benveniste's vocabulary project and Dumézil's ideology project, and then to talk again about the controversy about these ideas in relation to some of the political questions that have been raised about this work. Now, Dumézil and Benveniste are friends and colleagues, but they're also contrasting figures in many ways. As I said, Benveniste primarily known as a linguist, and his earliest works on the Indo-European language family, two very specialized works on the linguistics. Whereas with Dumézil, it takes him a while before he really works out what he's doing, but it's in 1938 that he publishes an article where he says this is really, in retrospect, he will come to see this as the crucial breakthrough moment in his work. It's an article that then is developed in several books that follow, including this book, Mitra Varuna, which I've recently edited a new edition in English. Dumézil sees a threefold structure within mythological traditions and social divisions. He says, often in very different contexts, you can find traces of this same kind of structure. The three main divisions between a ruling class of priests and of kings, a second class of warriors, and a third of producers or farmers. So he shows there's parallels between the Roman gods Jupiter, Mars, Quirinus, and the three social classes of Vedic India, for example. And this is what's known as his trifunctional hypothesis. And he extends this analysis by saying there's an underlying tripartite structure of Indo-European mythology. The first function comprising the sacred and sovereignty, the second, the general use of force, and the third, production and reproduction or fecundity. So priests, warriors, and then farmers or traders in the third caste that correspond to gods, to social classes, and other social orderings. And traces of this division, he says, can be found in diverse sources. The Indian caste system, the three Roman gods, but parallels too in Norse mythology with Odin, Thor, and the Vanir group of gods, in Vedic mythology with Varuna, with Indra, and the Ashvin. And then this trifunctional structural hypothesis that he makes is then used to study a range of places across historical periods. And Dumézil's own geographical reach is vast. It goes from India through Iran, through the Caucasus, to Greece, to Rome, to Scandinavia, Wales, and Ireland. Rome, Norse, and Vedic sources are his primary material, but he explores these in a range of other contexts as well. So that gives some sense, I hope, of Dumézil's comparative breadth in terms of the mythology project. And his broad point is that when we're studying these things, we need to explore the relations between elements, between gods, people, group, characteristics, rather than simply look at them in isolation. It's only through the comparison of the relation that you can uncover the structural similarities. So he stresses it's not just comparison of the same, but it's situation in relation to difference. Dumézil's career takes a while to get going. He's initially advised by Antoine Mellet that his academic future lies outside of France, and he spends several years teaching in visiting posts in Warsaw, in Istanbul, and in Uppsala. He did his military service as an artillery officer in the First World War. Van Beneest, in contrast, was a private tutor in India in the 1920s. He did his military service in the Rif War in Morocco, despite having signed a manifesto against that conflict. Van Beneest is a very private man. There's very little that's revealed even in his correspondence, but his political sympathies seem to have been on the left, whereas Dumézil's political sympathy is very clearly on the right. In the 1920s, Dumézil was close to Action Française and through his friend Pierre Gaxotte to the leader of Action Française, Charles Murat, before Dumézil does journalism for the right-wing press that was published under a pseudonym. And in the 1980s, a debate about Dumézil's political sympathies blew up. It was sparked by a remark initially by the Italian classicist Arnaldo Momigliano and then followed by the historian Carlo Ginzburg, and that Dumézil was defended by Didier Erebon, among others. Erebon, best known, I think, as a biographer of Foucault. I'm just going to try and move this out of the way. So I have a window with snapshots of each of you that's online. And I'm afraid it's getting in the way of the screen that I'm trying to share. Now, Dumézil and Van Beneest both lose their teaching positions under the Vichy regime, but for different reasons and with different outcomes. Van Beneest was Jewish, and he lost his position while he was a prisoner of war. He'd been captured by the Germans shortly before the armistice, and when he escaped from his prisoner of war camp, he went into exile in Switzerland. His brother, though, was arrested in Paris and deported to Auschwitz, where he was killed. Dumézil was deployed to Turkey as part of the French military mission, but he had earlier been a Freemason, and so when he returned to Paris after the armistice, he was excluded from teaching because of the Vichy laws on secret societies. He got his teaching position back during the war. He remained in Paris, and he published through the war with Gallimard, which is well known as a press that collaborated with the occupying authorities. So So at the liberation, Dumézil was under suspicion of collaboration and temporarily lost his teaching positions again. He did get them back, but this is an early stage of the controversy about his political positions. And much of the story of Bamberniste's war and Dumézil's war I've uncovered through pursuing traces in archives. Now, the nature of the academic work that Bamberniste and Dumézil means that they have contacts with a wide range of researchers in Europe and beyond. So Bamberniste had examined the doctoral thesis of Harold Bailey, who taught at SOAS in London and then was professor of Sanskrit at the University of Cambridge. And they have a lifelong correspondence. It's actually the most extensive correspondence I've found that is very revealing for their shared research interests. Bamberniste was also close to Walter Bruno Henning, who was a German scholar who'd worked with Friedrich Karl Andreas in Berlin, and then goes into exile in England in the 1930s because he has a Jewish fiancé. Dumézil was close to Swedish scholars that he'd met in his time in the country in the 1930s, notably Henrik Samuel Nyberg and his two most famous students, Stig Verkander and Geo Vindegren. And it's in Uppsala that Dumézil first meets Otto Hörfler, whose work on male warrior bands directly led to Hörfler's role in the SS Achenerbe, a pseudo-scientific research institute that had been set up by Heinrich Himmler, attempting to connect mythology with Nazi racial doctrines. Dumézil was also close to Jan de Vries in the Netherlands, who was a Nazi collaborator during the war. And it's the political affiliations of some of these people that have called Dumézil's own politics into question. Dumézil was also instrumental in the career of the historian of religion Mircea Eliade, who spent a decade in Paris after the Second World War. Eliade had been tied to the Romanian fascist Iron Guard, and that makes his return to communist Romania impossible. And although Eliade relocates to Chicago in 1955, Dumézil remains in close contact with him, and Eliade is crucial in the Anglophone reception of Dumézil. He commissions some of the first translations of Dumézil's work and arranges some of his visiting posts in the United States. But fortunately, Bamberniste and Dumézil also have contact with some less problematic figures. So they're close to Marie-Louise Sjöstedt as an important scholar of Welsh and Irish language and myth, who died in the Second World War, and both have close links to Claude Lévi-Strauss, who makes use of linguistics famously in his anthropological work. And although Roman Jakobson is the key linguistic figure for Lévi-Strauss's work, he's also explicit about his debts to Dumézil. His mythologies is sometimes seen as an inspiration for Dumézil's myth and epic series. I'll talk about that in a moment. Bamberniste and Lévi-Strauss are colleagues, and they edit the journal L'Homme, Man, together alongside the geographer Pierre Gouraud. And Bamberniste and Dumézil have friendships, rivalries, or shared interests with another wide range of significant figures in French and European intellectual life. Ramon Laurent, Georges Bataille, Roger Calois, Henri Corbin, Alexander Kachev, Alexander Quare, Roman Jakobson, Jacques Lacan, Georges Rodin, Nikolai Trubetskoy, and many others. Now, Bamberniste's election to the Collège de France is in 1937. He succeeds Antoine Mellet to the chair in comparative grammar. He'd previously replaced Mellet as a teacher of the École de Haute Etude and taught comparative grammar and Iranian there. He also wrote a short foreword to, Antoine Mellet wrote a short foreword to a 1928 collection of texts by friends of Bamberniste. And in that text, Mellet writes about this new generation of scholars. You can see many of them there in the photo with him. The scholars that had worked with him and others after the First World War. And he says it was never so clear that there was a group of students who were so obviously going to be masters themselves. And they published this book in tribute to Bamberniste, even though he's only in his mid-20s at the time. And Mellet is explicit in his foreword to this about Bamberniste being the next in the lineage of linguistics. So he says, Michel Brielle opened the door to Ferdinand de Saussure, Ferdinand de Saussure to Louis Devaux and to me, Mellet. Emile Bamberniste has succeeded me. The necessary renewal has been achieved. And in the final 2 years of his life, Mellet was too unwell to give his courses at the Collège de France, and Bamberniste gives the courses in his place. After Mellet's death in 37, Pelliot advocates for the continuation of this chair And Bamboniste is the one that is elected to this. So Bamboniste is teaching at the Collège de France before he's been awarded his doctoral degree. And 18 months after its defence, he's in a permanent position there. So he's teaching there in a permanent position from when he was just 32. Now, unfortunately, his inaugural lecture hasn't been preserved. There's just a single page of it that's in the archive, and it wasn't published, unlike most people who give inaugural lectures at the college. And as I said, he loses his position during the Vichy regime, but when those restrictions are rescinded at the liberation, he resumes teaching there in 1944-45, and I'll come back to that in a moment. De Maizière's election to the Collège de France is much more controversial. Archaeologist Albert Granier had left a chair vacant when he retired, and Bamboniste writes the proposal for a chair in Indo-European civilization to replace it, and with de Maizière as the intended candidate. And just say with the Collège de France elections, they vote first on the topic of a chair and then on the person to occupy that chair. But the topic of the chair is usually so specialised that there is really one candidate already in mind, which everybody is aware of, but there's this ritualistic process of you decide on the topic and then you decide on the person. At this initial proposal of the Indo-European Civilization Chair, the Slavonic philologist André Mazon and some of his colleagues try and get a delay in making a decision, but that's defeated at the assembly of the professors. Mazon says at the time the reason they want a delay is so that they can consider Pierre Teilhard de Chardin for a chair in prehistory instead. This is defeated, and then they go forward at the next meeting to a vote on who will hold the chair. Bamboniste presents both de Maizière and the much more junior Emmanuel Laroche as the second line candidate. And just again to say about their election process, the second line candidate is this kind of nominal figure who's put up to give some kind of degree of choice, and they're often elected to a chair themselves several years later. So de Maizière had been the second line candidate for a chair in the 1930s, and Laroche, who's now the second line candidate in de Maizière's election, Laroche eventually succeeds Bamboniste to a chair in the early 1970s. So there's never any realistic sense that the second line candidate will be elected, but it's this giving a semblance of choice in the process. Now, there are several people that speak in favour of de Maizière's candidacy. One of his colleagues from Istanbul gives a statement that is read by Lucien Febvre of the Annales School, talking about how creative de Maizière's work is and how much he has produced and how much he will likely continue to produce. But because de Maizière now is being explicitly raised as the candidate, Mazon has to oppose de Maizière explicitly. And he raises two challenges: whether there is such a thing called Indo-European civilization, and if the notion of a linguist or a linguistic language that can be reconstructed implies that there was a community of speakers of that language. And then the second thing he raises is, well, how could you study this in any case? Would it be possible, he says, a few millennia later, on the basis of a small number of etymologies and texts of questionable interpretation, to reconstruct a truly Indo-European civilization with its customs, beliefs, social structure, institutions, and the whole complex, which is a civilization? That would be a singularly anachronistic and, let's face it, chimeric view today. So he said the whole project is a house of cards. It's building on sand. And his second challenge is to de Maizière's credentials. He says they're not sufficient in this area. And he says, I won't underestimate what he's done in his work. I won't deny his erudition, the variety of his interests, his subtle ingenuity, the combative energy of his pen. But he says his work to this day is primarily in the areas of Caucasian linguistics, comparative mythology, and folklore. And he says this isn't worthy of a chair. He says the teaching program then has a chimeric title, and the candidate has research that is not under that label, a double confusion that I, for one, do not wish to associate myself with. And there are other people that voice opposition to him, notably the administrator, the medievalist Edmond Farrell. But at the vote, which is quite close, 24 in favour of de Maizière and 15 against, he is elected to this chair. So this is the Assembly of Professors in 1951. You can see how male-dominated this is. But Mazon's opposition gives a sense of how polarised the decisions could be. In retrospect, I think if we look at some of the people that held chairs at the college, it's easy to think that they were a foregone conclusion. But strong candidates could be unsuccessful. Claude Lévi-Strauss was first considered for a chair in 1949 and again in 1950 when it's Ban van Eest who is advocating for him, but neither time is the idea supported. Lévi-Strauss is first elected a whole decade later when he's proposed by the philosopher Maurice Merleau-Ponty. But as I said, the male-oriented or male-dominated assembly of professors, the same in 1967. And then in 1986, where I think the second person to hold a chair, second woman to hold a chair at the Collège de France, François Héritier, in the front row there. Another unsuccessful candidacy was Alexandre Coiré, the philosopher and historian of sciences, who was proposed for a chair in 1951 but was unsuccessful. And that's a story I tell in a piece that's just been published in the History of European Ideas. Now, Dumézil's inaugural lecture is given on the 1st of December 1949 and is published in 1950. And in it, he raises this challenge that Mazon and his colleagues had raised, and he tries to confront it head on. He says, Indo-European civilization is not something that can be treated like a Syrian, Chinese, or Roman civilization through direct observation and description. So this is for a simple reason. We have no archives, no literary documents, no monuments. Scholars then are required to work with much later material and through comparison to identify the inheritance of the shared past. So the work he's doing, he says, is not prehistory, but history. It's working with the oldest accessible history of each of the people that are known to have contained an Indo-European element strong enough to impose its language, and that therefore from that language and from the other sources that we have, we might be able to reconstruct something about their shared past. All things considered, he says, the inadequacy of the label of Indo-European is precisely what recommends it. It is revealed as what it must be, a conventional sign, a warning sign that is the hypothesis of a community of origin, of a common heritage, that is the most plausible explanation for the correspondence that one can make out among the historical facts so scattered across the land. He means in India, in Iran, in Rome, in Greece, in Scandinavia, and so on. And from that recognition, he says, comes some methodological principles. The goal of comparativists in linguistics, as elsewhere, is therefore modest. They know it is impossible to reconstruct the living drama of a common ancestral language or civilization, because nothing can replace documents, and there are no documents. So they have to work with the documents that we have from the later societies, the Indian, the Roman, the Scandinavian ones, to locate in them the homologous facts, and between which the homology is such that it suggests as its most likely explanation a common origin. So while comparative Indo-European linguistics, he says, is well established, work on civilization is more contested, but it proceeds on similar principles. Again, it's not simply looking for similarities, but rather similarities against a background of differences. That we have to confront, measure and limit similarities and try and explain them. And it's the shared ideology, his term, or framework, that is what he intends to study. To sum up, he says, it seems to me the hypothesis of fortuitous coincidences and that of several similar fabrications dictated by the conditions of the human mind or collective life do not correspond to the conditions of the human mind or collective, do not correspond to the breadth and coherence and originality of the correspondences that we can see between these different groups. The hypothesis of borrowing in the general case is not adequate to the vital importance of concordant systems, nor to the fact that they are observed exclusively among people speaking languages derived from Indo-European. He says we can look at other language groups and we can see different things there, but there is something shared between those that speak Indo-European languages. The explanation, he says, that raises the least difficulty is inheritance. And he closes the lecture with comments about the source material. This will be familiar to anybody who'd read any of his earlier books. He talks about his immediate program of teaching that he plans for the next year or two. He indicates, as they generally do in these inaugural lectures, the lineage of previous professors that he wants to set himself as following. So he mentions Mauss, Hubert, Grenet. And he says that with this establishment of a chair, these walls will once again witness not the flawless display of refined knowledge, but trial and error, repentance, successive approximations, i.e. research in progress. What he says is the horrible birth of what will later, much later, be inoffensive little truths in textbooks. So it's a real sense that he wants to give an insight into his research as an ongoing program, which is what the lectures at the Collège de France are supposed to do. So for nearly 20 years then, Van Beneest and Dumézil teach in parallel at the Collège de France, from Dumézil's election in 49, when he joins Van Beneest there, until 1968, when Dumézil retires. So at the Collège de France, in central to intellectual life in France, 20 years of the two of them teaching Indo-European and other questions in parallel. The Van Beneest lectures principally on linguistics, but secondarily on vocabulary, and Dumézil principally on mythology, but also on Caucasian linguistics and folklore. And the yearbook of the Collège de France provides a lot of detail about their teaching. It's not as detailed as it is for some other people. So, for example, Foucault's course summaries were published as a book in 1989 to give a sense of his whole teaching trajectory before they then went on and transcribed the recordings they had of the lectures at the college. The same with Claude Lévi-Strauss, the book was published of his course summaries. With both Van Beneest and Dumézil, their summaries are much shorter, but they still give a lot of information about their work. Dumézil said that he didn't want to share too much in advance of his own publication because he worried about less scrupulous colleagues who might exploit that material. But much of Dumézil's teaching reports on his publications, and there are instances where he effectively takes the course manuscript and that becomes the first draft of the book manuscript, and there's a clear line often between his teaching and his subsequent publications. Van Beneest doesn't provide that much detail either, and there are links between his teaching and his publications, but they're not always as direct. But the archives of both of them do contain many of their lecture manuscripts. Now, with Dumézil, they are extremely well organized. Each lecture is numbered and dated, and if he takes material out of a course manuscript to use it for another purpose, to reuse it for another Paris lecture or to give it as a lecture somewhere else, he generally puts a note in there to say exactly where he will find it in his papers. The problem is that his manuscript pages look like this. His handwriting is extremely difficult to read. And although he begins most of his lectures in quite a clear way in the right-hand margin of a page, he adds so many things into the left margin that he frequently has to spill over onto extra slips of paper that are pasted onto the sides of the lecture notes. And these are all sorts of odd scraps of paper. This is before post-it notes, I guess. They're flyers for other talks that he's cut up, bits of letters, invoices from his wine merchant, and so on. Van Beneest's handwriting is much easier to read, but his archive is much less complete. Things aren't dated, the archives are not organized chronologically or thematically, and so it's not always clear where material should go, and his notes are often much less prepared. But let me pick two examples from their work that connects to this question of ideology. The first one is on Van Beneest's vocabulary project. During the wartime absence, Van Beneest's chair at the Collège de France wasn't filled. For 1939-1940, the yearbook says that he will give a course on research on Indo-European vocabulary, but it doesn't take place because he's mobilized, he's part of the French army, and then he's a prisoner. And for the next 4 years, he's unable to teach at the college. After the war, he returns and he begins a course on the 9th of January 1945, and his course has almost exactly the same title as the one he would have given 5 years before, but with one addition. So instead of Indo-European vocabulary, it's now the vocabulary of Indo-European institutions. And in the retrospective report he gives of that course, he says this was a vast subject of which he'd done only limited work until this time. He says that the aim is to show through a detailed study that the vocabulary of the Indo-European languages can shed light on abolished institutions, and that a careful analysis makes it possible to detect important notions that survive in only one language. Now, his 1969 book, The Vocabulary of Indo-European Institutions, is already a very political book. I mean, it's talking about the structure of society and economy. It's talking about the king. It's talking about relations between groups within society and the organization of society. But in 1944-45, these themes are explicitly political, it seems to me. We therefore examined, he says, the words, through the words that express them, the structure and divisions of society, as well as its territorial organization, the notions of society and family, of free man and slave, then the notion of modalities of law, those of authority and censorship, and finally, in religious terminology, the notions of sacredness and sacrifice, of prayer and offering, of religion and superstition. And in the themes of the family, which was particularly important under Vichy, with the motto of work, family, homeland, replacing the French Revolution, equality, fraternity, liberty. But also these themes of law, censorship, authority, territory, these relations to what in 1945 would have been very explicitly political questions. And then for the next few years, he announces courses and reports on his courses in the usual way. He would usually give one course on linguistics and another on vocabulary. Some of these vocabulary courses are on the Indo-European institutions project, but others report on field work that he'd done, for example, in Afghanistan, in Iran, and then later in Alaska and British Columbia. So in 1945-46, he gives a course on vocabulary that talks about kingship, being a king, the nature of the king and the relation of the king to the people. He stresses the way that he will talk about the vocabulary of oaths, of acts of offering and consecration, and how religious speech can be taken forward in different types of institutions. And he has an essay on the oath in ancient Greece in 1948 that draws on some of this teaching. And many of his future courses approach this question, albeit from a different angle. So he's talking about economic notions, wealth and property, exchange, commercial transaction, spatial relationships, which I think is interesting because that's largely neglected in the published book. And then in 1951-52, says this will be my final course on Indo-European vocabulary. Now in the late 40s and early 50s, Bamanis doesn't publish very many studies on Indo-European vocabulary, even though these courses give him a large amount of material to work with. But he does publish a little, but these lectures were clearly transcribed by somebody who was in the audience, because later these lectures form the basis for the book that he's published so many years later in 1969. So I think what happens in this book is that the manuscript of these early courses from the 40s and the 1950s is used as the basis for what he will then edit into the book that is published in 1969. It's a book that's published in a series that is edited by Pierre Bourdieu at Édition de Minuit. And the preface says that they gave the transcripts of the manuscripts of the text to Bourdieu in 1967. But the courses clearly show that much of the work was done in a much earlier period. And there's a very complicated story, I think, to tell about how the material was transcribed and edited by Jean Lalot. Jean Lalot is credited in the published book for the index, for the table of languages, and for writing short summaries of each of the chapters. But I think Lalot did a lot more than this. I think what he did was take the transcripts of Bamanist's courses from the 40s and 50s, put them into a form that then Bamanist himself could edit into what becomes the published book. So I think there's a long story to be told about how the book was produced. But the production of the book in the 40s and 50s in content ties it, I think, very explicitly to some of Bamanist's experiences during the war, the stuff about being a prisoner of war, for example, the notion of sacrifice, some of the religious vocabulary, some of the political questions that would have been to the fore in the war years and so on. Now, not all of the material in the book dates from that earlier period. There are later talks that Bamanist gives where there's material that can be quite explicitly dated to that particular delivery of that. But a lot of it, I think, in sacrifice and hospitality and so on, relates to Bamanist's biography and his experiences in the war, much more than I think has generally been acknowledged. The second thing I want to say something briefly about from the teaching is Dumézil. In his 1953-54 course, he talks about what he calls the ideology of the three cosmic and social functions of the Indo-Europeans. It's a course that he continues the following year with another course on trifunctionalism in the cults, literature and laws of Indo-European peoples. And he qualifies his regular use of the term structure, but now with ideological. He's increasingly using ideology to describe the three functions, and this, I think, is a significant shift in his work. In his 1956 book on the warrior function, He talks about the way that the function of the particular class of legends known as myths is to express dramatically the ideology under which a society lives, not only to hold out to its conscience the values it recognises and the ideals it pursues from generation to generation, but above all to express its very being and structure, the elements, connections, the balances, the tensions that constitute it, to justify the rules and traditional practices without which everything within a society would disintegrate. And what's key here, I think, is this term ideology. It comes through in his course summaries, I think, from the early to mid-1950s. It's a shift away from thinking that the trifunctional hypothesis can be seen in the social organization intact in the societies that he's studying. But he's trying now to say it's rather an overarching mindset that they would have shared that elements of or traces of can be found in their social structures. And his book, The Tripartite Ideology of the Indo-Europeans, which is often seen as the moment when in his published work this becomes most explicit. This is a book that develops very explicitly from this teaching at the Collège de France. It's a course from 1957-58 that is the most explicit link to the published book. It's a course, he says, was a critical review of 20 years of research on Indo-European religion. So 1958, it's 20 years after that 1938 essay that he'd seen as his breakthrough moment. And he calls it a review, a bilan is the French, so an assessment or a critical summary, an update. The word's also used for a balance sheet. And that's a word, the bilan word, is something that's important for his later work because a decade on, he uses it to describe a program of publication. I'm going to come back to that briefly at the end. But the book, The Ideology of the Indo-Europeans, he says that it's never going to be a question in this book of the habitat of the Indo-Europeans, of the paths of their migration, nor of their material civilization. On these strongly debated points, the method employed here has no purchase, and from the other side, the solution hardly matters to the problem posed here. The Indo-European civilization we are considering is that of the mind. And the book concentrates on those questions. It's an initial guide. It's quite a good introductory book to introduce de Maizière's work. But it also is a guide through the publications he's already produced. But it's also a sort of tidying up or a fine-tuning, a synthesis of where he's got to at this point. But it's this focus on ideology that I think is important here. It dated to this 1958 book, but there are elements of it that come through in his teaching before that date. Okay, I'm going to come to a conclusion by talking about briefly a 2004 report that the French historian of Vichy and its legacies, Henri Rousseau, published. It was a commission that had been set up to examine racism and Holocaust denial at the University of Jean Moulin, Lyon-Trois. Now, one of the leading academics at Lyon-Trois was Jean Audry, who died just a couple of years ago, who'd been a professor of linguistics and Sanskrit at Lyon-Trois. His doctoral thesis on Vedic grammar was defended in 1975, and he published a whole range of very specialist academic works, but he's also the author of two books in the popular Cassege series with Presse Université de France. One of them was, at the time at least, the standard French introduction to the Indo-European language, and the other is a book on the people that are supposed to have spoken that language. So the linguistic study, the first of these, was written on de Maizière's recommendation to the press. I suspect that they'd asked him to write the study first. And it's a detailed and naturally very technical study and has a lot of reliance on earlier Indo-European linguistic work, including the work of Benveniste. But towards the end of the second edition of the language book, Audry indicates that the reconstruction work cannot or doesn't have to simply be limited to the field of form. The work of Georges de Maizière has demonstrated the existence of content that is common to works conceived independently and as different as epic, saga, novel, and history. So his book on the language anticipates the book on the people. He says, although there are challenges, it is possible to say something about how the people who spoke the language thought by looking at their lexicon. And this is, he says, despite the challenges of there not being texts in the reconstructed language. And that's the purpose of the second of these books, On the People, the much more controversial study, because it defends this idea that there were a distinct people who spoke this reconstructed language. And although this was Audrey's own initiative, he does say that de Maizière read the manuscript for him, although it has that standard academic disclaimer that Audrey alone is responsible for what use is made of it. It actually sounds like that de Maizière tried to persuade him not to publish the book because it was so controversial and he thought problematic, but Audrey went ahead with the book. It's a book that talks about the Indo-European people in terms of their view of the world, their community, their religion, their institutions, about relations of war, production, reproduction, the places they lived. And it makes a lot of use of de Maizière's work, it makes a lot of use of Balmanis' work, but it also uses much more problematic figures, including Roger Pearson, who died again a couple of years ago, but a British anthropologist who had held positions in the USA, but was also a white supremacist, eugenicist, and founder of the Northern League. Now, de Maizière had had links to Pearson directly. He published in Pearson's Journal of Indo-European Studies. Audrey was a member of a pseudo-academic group known as GRES, French word for Greece, but as an acronym for the Group of Research and Study on Indo-European Civilization. That was a group that had been founded by Alain de Benoist as part of the Nouvelle Droite, the New Right. And Audrey broke with that group and was important in founding the far-right group Terre et Peuple, so the Earth and People, or Land and People group. And it's all of these kinds of associations that lead to the setting up of the commission to examine the racism and Holocaust denial that was being taught at Lyon-Trois after Audrey had retired. Now, de Maizière rather, was linked to Benoist's journal Nouvelle École. He'd been interviewed by the journal. There was a special issue that was dedicated to his work in 1972-73 that led to a book that was published by the Copernic Press, which was a Grasse publishing house. It was actually, apart from a festschrift for de Maizière, it was the first book devoted to de Maizière's work in France. And de Maizière tried to distance himself from this journal when the controversy blew up, because it raised a whole set of questions about where de Maizière's own political sympathies lay. But this wasn't entirely fair on de Maizière's part to say that he had nothing really to do with this journal. He had been interviewed by the journal, and when he tried to further disassociate himself, Benoist published their correspondence in the journal, which showed that they'd had quite friendly relations for some time. Just to give an idea of this journal, if you know Geoffrey Hirth's work on reactionary modernism, the kind of juxtaposition of a rocket and this kind of idealized warrior figure on a horse maybe gives some idea of the kind of positions they have. And it's all these links to Audrey, to Pearson, to Benoist that expose some of the politics of de Maizière's work and lead to some of the questions that were raised about it. But this is a whole decade before the Carlo Ginzburg accusations from the mid-1980s. But work on the Indo-European can't simply be associated with this problematic politics, and Balmanis is a good example of that, as somebody who was seen as politically on the left but also Jewish, who was working in a similar kind of vein. But the politics of this project are something that's very much to the fore in my concerns about it. So just to finish, late in their lives, Balmanis and de Maizière become important mentor figures to a new generation of academics in France. Roland Barthes, Michel Foucault, Yulia Kosteva, Tsvetan Todorov, and many others. So many of the more familiar names of French theory are explicit about their debt to these earlier Indo-European scholars. So Barthes acknowledges Balmanis' work on linguistics, particularly Kosteva's earliest books are engagements with developments in linguistics and semiology. Foucault first meets de Maizière in the 1950s, and de Maizière provides both very material support to Foucault's career, but also Foucault uses some of de Maizière's analyses in his own lectures particularly. And I have a piece in Journal of the History of Ideas last year that explores the Foucault-de Maizière relation. And there are many other links. Deleuze and Guattari used de Maizière's work in The Thousand Plateaux, for example. Derrida, many of the recently published seminars of Derrida often begin with an entry from Balmanis' vocabulary and then deconstruct it, that use it or critique it. I mentioned the stuff on hospitality, but Derrida also uses Bamini's work on the gift, on perjury, on pardoning, on testimony, and many other themes. And Dumézil, in his last years, does both this bilan period of publication, where he says that he's going to revise a whole range of his earlier studies. He says, in an effort to prepare for the inevitable autopsy as proper a cadaver as possible, to deliver to the critic of the near future in an organized and improved form the results of the endeavors of varying success carried out over the past 30 years, again dating it to that breakthrough 1938 text. And the Myth and Epic series is three volumes, each substantial books, but they're all brought together in a quarto volume, that provide a great summary of what Dumézil is doing in his work. It's not been fully translated into English, but it presents different parts of the trifunctional hypothesis with different evidence from different places. And there are other books that he publishes in that late 60s, early 70s period, where he is summarizing or improving and enhancing work that he has done previously. And in the final years of his life, he publishes a series of what he calls sketches, esquisses, that are themes that he says, I no longer have the time, in his 80s at the time, I no longer have the time myself to develop these further, but here are all my working notes, here are all the sources that might be useful for others to pick up and potentially use themselves. And he publishes three volumes of 25 sketches, and a further 25 were published posthumously. Bamini's essays were not collected in quite the systematic way as that, but there have been some volumes of Bamini's posthumously to bring together some of his texts. But with both of them, the volume of material that they published, with Dumézil it took a book to catalogue all of Dumézil's publications. With Bamini's it took a long essay in one of the Festschrift volumes to catalogue all of that material. And it's using all of that material, their published books obviously, but also the articles, the reviews, their teaching records and the manuscripts in the archives, to try to reconstruct the path of their thought, but how it connects to a range of other thinkers, both in France and outside, to try to produce what I hope will become a book. The working title is Mapping Indo-European Thought in 20th Century France. Bamini's and Dumézil as the central figures, but to try to think about all of these different connections they have in France and outside, and how, in a coda I suspect, how the political associations have marginalised work on Indo-European thought. And we might say that that is with good reason. But I'll stop there. Thank you.